Thank you all for braving the hurricane and coming this morning. I'm Sherry Schrager, as you have just heard. I have a tremendous amount to get through today, so I will make a deal with you. I'm going to talk fast. I advise you to read as fast as you possibly can, and I will be happy to take questions either after my talk or after the session is over so we don't eat into these other fine people's time. I have no conflicts of interest. However, I would like to take this opportunity to thank our funders at NIDA and remind you that NIDA claims neither credit nor blame for anything I'm about to tell you today. Prescription drug abuse is on the rise, especially among young adults. In particular, we're very concerned about opioid misuse, which is the most frequently misused class of prescription drugs. It's particularly an issue because it has been associated with poor outcomes, including injection drug use, drug dependence, and even fatal overdose. But it's not simply the use that's the problem. The longer duration or career of misuse has also been associated with substance use disorders and ultimate transition to heroin use. But wait, there's more. Mode of administration turns out to matter too. So generally, when opioids are prescribed, they're prescribed in pill form, sometimes in a soluble or liquid form, but these are things that are generally swallowed, perhaps chewed. However, it is possible to crush or mash the pills to support an alternate mode of administration, such as smoking, snorting, or injecting medications, potentially to increase the potency of delivery. The alteration of form, as we're calling this, is itself associated with poor outcomes, again including dependence or overdose risk, and also likelihood of infectious disease, particularly among injection drug users. So, the study that we're presenting today want to describe the trajectories of opioid misuse among young adults, looking at all three of these factors: the duration of the misuse, recency of use, but also recency of form alteration. And personally, I think looking at trajectories is cool enough, but you like to get a little more bang for your buck with a study. So we're also looking at outcomes associated with these trajectories and potential predictors that would tell you who might wind up developing each of these trajectories over time. So, the study I'm presenting is part of a larger study that was taking place in Los Angeles and New York in late October 2009 through early 2011. To be eligible for our study, participants had to be between 16 and 25 years old, so again, young adults, who had misused at least one prescription opioid, tranquilizer, or stimulant within the past 90 days prior to their interview. And when we say misuse in this context, we're talking about taking prescription drugs when they were not prescribed for the respondent, or that they only took for the experience or feeling that it caused. This was a stratified design, so we were specifically targeting injection drug users, homeless non-injection drug users, or polydrug users who were neither IDUs nor homeless. This was to ensure a broad risk spectrum so that any results we got were not confounded with oversampling one of these categories. The parent study had nearly 600 participants in it. For the present analysis, we had to exclude 21 participants who had never misused opioids, since this is an opioid misuse analysis. Okay. When we're talking about trajectories, it's important to note that this was a cross-sectional study, a one-time data collection event, but we did capture information that looked at the historical misuse of opioids. So we started by looking at duration of their opioid misuse career, which we defined as simply as their current age minus the age at which they first misused opioids. So it gives you a sense of how long they had been misusing these substances. We also asked questions about how recently they had misused opioids, and this was recoded into three binary variables representing whether they had misused their prescription opioids within the past 12 months, within the past 3 months, and within the past 30 days. Similarly, we asked about how recently they had altered the form of any opioids, and again recoded that into binary variables representing 12-month, 3-month, and 30-day use. As a reminder, when we're talking about alteration of form, we mean injecting, snorting, or smoking what should have been orally administered medications. Predictors of trajectories that we wanted to consider included demographic variables, of course. We wanted to know if there were site differences or differences based on individual variables like race, gender, sexual identity, socioeconomic status growing up, and current school enrollment, which has previously been found to be protective. We wanted to look at risk background and behavior, so history of ever having been in foster care, homeless, injection drug users, being enrolled in a drug treatment program, or a prior history of overdose. We wanted to look at their own prescription history, so did it matter that they themselves were previously prescribed opioids, tranquilizers, or stimulants, and whether their parents or somebody in their household had had a prescription for opioids. And finally, we wanted to consider potential effects of parental drug misuse, so whether their parents had ever abused prescription drugs, used illicit drugs, or sniffed or injected any drug in the in the case that they may have been modeling this behavior for the respondents. Outcomes of our trajectory analysis, since we did have variables that included up to the past 30-day behavior, we couldn't really have any outcomes that went prior to 30 days. So within the past 30 days, we wanted to know if they were also concurrently using prescription tranquilizers and any other drugs that have previously been associated with opioid misuse, including heroin, cocaine, or crystal meth, and finally, whether they had been showing any signs of drug dependence, including daily use of opioids or any withdrawal symptoms. Okay. If you will allow me 30 seconds just to get you out here a little bit, this is pretty cool. So what we did is took this set of seven indicators that I described before, the duration, three indicators of use, three indicators of form alteration, and did what's called a latent class or latent profile analysis. I don't want to get too hung up on the jargon, but the idea is you let the data sort itself out and tell you exactly how many trajectories, how many different unique experiences over time there really are captured by these nearly 600 participants in the data. So what you get out is a sense of trajectories that say one class looks like this and there's a certain number of people in that class, one class looks like this, et cetera, et cetera. Following that, we did what's called auxiliary analysis to look at the outcomes. This just means that we're not letting the outcomes influence the class structure. The class structure is set and we're seeing if it's associated with those outcomes. And then we did a latent class regression analysis to see if the predictors were associated with likelihood of developing one trajectory versus another. So, very, very briefly, just to highlight some descriptive results, this table is actually even longer than this. We're not even going into the demographic stuff. I just would like to point out that the average duration was about 5.3 years. Keep in mind, again, these are participants who are 16 to 25 years old. So 5 years is a not insignificant amount of time for them. Nearly 92% had abused opioids within the past 12 months, unsurprising since abusing some sort of prescription substance was part of the enrollment criteria. However, I found it interesting that over half the sample had altered the form of their medication within the past 12 months. That was not an enrollment criterion and something that was notable as a result of the study. 73% of our sample was homeless, again, potentially inflated given that current homelessness was one of our strata that we wanted to recruit into. But it's just something good to take into account. Nearly three quarters of them had previously had their own opioid prescription, so that's something to keep in mind as you're interpreting the results. And non-trivial percentages of them reported having parents who were engaged in some sort of drug involvement and concurrent use of tranquilizers, heroin, cocaine, meth, and potentially signs of dependence. Okay. So this is the result of our latent class or latent profile analysis. What you see here is a graph representing probabilities of engaging as you go across in 12-month use, 12-month form alteration, 3-month use, 3-month form alteration, 30-day use, 30-day form alteration. And the best fitting solution for our data had four classes. So the first class, class one, the red line right across the top, nearly a quarter of the sample fell into this class. And this is what we're thinking of as our really intense high-risk users. So these are people who, at 12 months prior to their interview, all of them, 100% of them, had been misusing prescription opioids, and 100% of them had been altering the form of that opioid in order to take it. At 3 months, same thing, 100% use, 100% alteration. At 30 days, 100% use, 100% alteration. So these people are just going strong all the way through. Class 2 is the green line. Starts off looking a lot like class 1. At 12 months and 3 months, everybody is using, everybody is altering the form of their medication, but within the past 30 days, something interesting is happening. About half of them have stopped using, and all of the ones who still use have stopped altering the form. So the difference between these two classes is what's been happening in the 30 days prior to the interview. So there might be some differences in risk there. Class 3 is the really interesting one. That's the blue one that makes all the nice jagged lines. These are people who look a lot like class 2 in terms of their use. So everybody was using at 12 months, everybody was using at 3 months. A little more than half of them were still using within 30 days prior to the interview, but they are not nearly as invested in altering the form of their medication. So only 20% of them had altered the form within the past 12 months, and within the past 3 months, none of them were doing that anymore. So that's a distinct pattern within our data. And finally, class 4 are our quitters. About half of them had used within the last 12 months, 20% had altered. By 3 months, none of them are using anymore. So again, keep in mind this was a study of prescription drug abusers, so the fact that they're not misusing prescription opioids tells you they're still misusing stimulants or tranquilizers because they're in our study. But at least as far as opioid use goes, they have cooled it on that. So not depicted in this, because this is a picture of probabilities, is their career duration of use, but that decreases in a stepwise fashion if you're thinking of these as ordered in terms of risk, class 1 being the highest risk, class 4 being the lowest risk for opioid use. The career follows really nicely, with class 1 having the longest career of about 6.5 years, class 4 having the shortest career of 4.5 years. Okay. These trajectories, in addition to being interesting in and of themselves, turn out to be associated with outcomes as well. In fact, the trajectories differentially predicted the likelihoods of all of our outcomes. The effect on meth use was marginal, but class 1 at least was significantly different from all the others. And in fact, the class 1 users, those red line, really intense guys at the top, had significantly higher probabilities of all other types of drug use, including prescription tranquilizers, heroin, cocaine, and meth, and had significantly higher probabilities of signs of dependence, including daily opioid use and withdrawal. Heroin also decreased from one class to the next, much like career duration. In terms of predictors associated with these trajectories, site, gender, and family prescription history were not associated and will not be discussed further. There are quite a few results here, so I'm just going to highlight a couple in the interest of time as we go through. I found it interesting that those who were poor or working class growing up had the least likelihood of being in class 4, which were the ones who had quit opioid misuse. So they're more likely to be engaging in some sort of ongoing use. Those who were in school were least likely to be those really intense users, and most likely to be the ones who had quit opioid misuse within the past 3 months. As far as risk or background and behavior, ever having been homeless, IDU, being in drug treatment, and previous overdose were all associated with likelihoods of being in that really intense super class at the top. As far as prescription history goes, it's just bad news all around. If you had been prescribed anything, you were most likely to be in that really intense class. And parental drug misuse, perhaps unsurprisingly, was also associated with the likelihood of being in that really, really intense class. So, in terms of highlights or conclusions from our study, we did find 4 latent classes, and these different trajectories that we found corroborated findings from the adult research world that duration is associated with likelihood of altering form, and that these variables are both associated with poorer outcomes. In particular, misuse of other prescription drugs such as tranquilizers, illicit drugs, and dependence are all associated with our trajectories, and those class 1 intense users have the highest probabilities for all of these outcomes. Risk factors for more intense trajectories included LGBT status, low SES, homelessness, IDU, drug treatment, previous overdose, any type of prescription, and parental drug misuse. Perhaps the silver lining here is that at least school enrollment may be protected against intense opioid misuse. The study did have a few limitations. We are none of us perfect. This was a guided survey interview type study, which was great for depth of information, potentially limiting in terms of self-report bias and recall bias, because we are collecting these data, asking about historical experiences. There may be some recall bias there. These were high-risk samples limited to Los Angeles and New York, so our results may not generalize to other large cities or other areas of the country that are not large cities like LA and New York. The big elephant in the room is that we are using cross-sectional data and analytic approaches to understand the longitudinal phenomenon, so it would be great if some future research could happen to actually collect these data longitudinally and use sophisticated methods to model those trajectories in real time. And finally, these are aggression analyses, so these are associative results. We can't say anything definitive about causation. In closing, I would like to acknowledge Carol and Alex, who did a wonderful job helping us with the background for the paper that this presentation was based on. Our data collection team, Cesar, Megan, and Alex H., did a phenomenal job recruiting nearly 600 prescription drug abusers into this study. I would like to acknowledge the role of the young adults who participated and shared their time and experiences with us. And thank you all for coming this morning and hearing me talk.
Do you have data regarding the parents' use of alcohol as well as the subjects and young adults who had adverse childhood experiences?
The question was if we have data on parents' use of alcohol and the child's early adverse experiences.
Yeah.
I believe we do. We have not investigated that as part of this analysis, but that's certainly something that we could take a look at. One of the things we didn't do is because it was so common, we were not considering alcohol and marijuana use as a big part of our prediction. But we can certainly take a look and see if there's enough variation to support further analysis in these variables. Oh, absolutely. We are working to publish that feverishly now. So as soon as we have some clearance on that, I'd be happy to send it your way. Mm-hmm. Come see me after.
Do you have any more comments about the, you said a lot of those young people had had prescription drugs given to them in previously?
Many of them had their own prescriptions, yes.
And
is
there a policy implication in that or clinical implication?
We're thinking about clinical or policy implications about prescribing opioids. Certainly, the results that are coming out of this study provide a very cautionary tale about the role of receiving your own opioid prescription as a young adult or even as a child. There was a talk given last year by one of my collaborators on this study, Carol Silva, looking at the role of having your own prescription. So I'd want to consult that paper, but generally, yes, there are absolutely something we should think about given the poorer outcomes among those who had their own prescriptions.
Any of those pain, previous injury, accident in this population?
We did include the DAST as part of our measures, and so we... No, I'm sorry, that's dependence. We did actually have a pain scale as part of our measures, which, again, did not factor into this analysis. It is something we've looked at, but as I recall, I don't think it's more about current pain as opposed to historical pain, so whatever issue they had that resulted in their own opioid prescription does not necessarily show up in that.
That was going to be, okay. My question was going to be, could we tell why they got the opioids? Because... Mm-hmm. Simply saying not to give them opioids probably isn't an adequate policy.
Right, exactly. When we're talking about prescription history, we are talking about presumed legitimate prescriptions that, you know, they had seen a clinician and received one. So,
and the question is, what's the social context? Like, are children who need opioids from some other reason which has to do with why they need them, not just their immediate cause, more at risk?
Mm-hmm. That is an excellent question, and our data don't necessarily speak to that, but it's certainly worth further consideration.
Yes, I would like to comment about the strategy that you used to select your sample, because you didn't start with a sample of people who are prescribed opioids and see what happens to them.
Right.
You seem to select, I'm not exactly sure what you selected.
Okay.
Clinical sample, I'm not sure.
So the question was about sampling. Our methodology was going out into the communities within LA and New York, looking, because again we were using a stratified procedure, looking for people, and the screening took place in various locales, including outside schools, parks, beaches, everywhere you could go, where young people who are likely to be prescription drug misusers hang out. And so we would screen just about anybody who came through looking like they might be part of the population, and if they passed the screening criteria, which included being of the correct age and having misused at least one prescription drug, again, opioids, tranquilizers, or stimulants, within the last 90 days, they were invited to take the full survey, which was about an hour and a half. The purpose of this study was specifically to look at people who were misusing prescription opioids. So we're not necessarily trying to generalize results to all people who are prescribed, because many people who are prescribed substances do not misuse them, and they're not the high-risk population that we're particularly trying to capture for this study.
I think, have you been waiting for to ask the question? No, you're just standing up. Okay. We're out of time.
Okay.
All right.
I'm certainly happy to discuss the study further. RPI is in the audience and might have some opinions of his own to weigh in on. So I'll be happy to turn this over, but I'll be here afterwards if you'd like. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Shearer.